Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I have to do something as a woman who will never fear for my children's lives in the way that Black women do.
Welcome to Manic Rambling Spiral. I'm John R. Bray.
And I'm Heather B. Armstrong.
And today we decided that it would be a really perfect time to talk about race with our children. Because this has been, for quite a while now, and continues to be a very important topic, to say the least.
Unfortunately, continues to be, I guess.
Yeah. Somehow we're still stuck at having to explain this to people. I don't know why.
I saw just now a picture on Facebook that said things aren't getting worse. Things are just being uncovered, which I thought was a really good way to put it.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't considered it or looked at it like that, but I think that's probably true with things like Twitter and Periscope and whatever. Now we're seeing all of the things that maybe some of us, you know, being that we're both white, mm-hmm. haven't really seen.
Haven't ever seen.
Right. And it's sick.
It's very sick and disturbing and traumatic for an entire race of people. And I was watching a Sunday morning show and they were talking about, you know, the rise of the individual journalist, because we all now are equipped with phones, which have the, you know, video capabilities. And it was two white men talking about, what does this mean for us? And I just wanted to like reach through the television and smack both of them and say, you guys are going to comment about what it means for people to have access to video and what that means for all of this. And you're going to wax poetic about the individual. It's like, you know what? Why don't you ask somebody whose life is being impacted by this, white journalist?
Exactly. And that's what it's hard though, right? Because it goes back to, you have a choice, I think, when you're white, to either stay quiet because you don't know what to say, or to try and say something. And I think a lot of times you're going to try and say something and it's going to be wrong. But as long as you're willing to understand why it's wrong and to maybe change the way you think or see it or say it next time, I think that's okay. But a lot of times you get these, you know, white journalists that talk about how it impacts them, how it impacts the white community. And that's kind of irrelevant in some ways.
It's completely irrelevant to the discussion at hand. And I wrote about this on my website, about saying it wrong, about going about it all in the wrong way. And it started, if I can share this story, it started at the Mom 2.0 Summit in 2014. I was scheduled to get on stage with four other people to talk about using our platform for good causes and to further, you know, to raise our voices for something other than just, you know, talking about our kids. And the conference organizer, right before we go on stage for the keynote, they had a woman by the name of Kelly Wickham come on stage to read a blog post that she had written that year. It was a blog post that she wrote after George Zimmerman had been acquitted of the murder of Trayvon. And she stood up on stage and everybody got really quiet. And it was the most scathing and blistering and brilliant takedown of the entire mommy blogging community. And
and she is a blogger, right?
She is.
Okay.
And I joke with her now because she and I have become very, very close because of this. We joke now and I'm like, yep, you stood up there and you're like, Heather Armstrong, I see you. Heather Armstrong. She's like, I see you all hashtagging gay pride. I see you all hashtagging feminist issues. I see you all hashtagging all of these other really important social justice issues, but you will not raise your voice about race. Where are you and why won't you do it? And this is a despicable behavior on your part. Why are you remaining silent when we, who are a part of your community, are facing this kind of injustice? Where are your voices? And I joke with her now because it was like every single time it was like, Heather Armstrong, I see you, Heather Armstrong. And this is right before I'm supposed to go on stage. And I sunk like lower and lower and lower into my seat because the whole time I'm thinking, I don't know how to write about it. I don't know what to say because I am a privileged white woman who has never been denied anything because of the color of her skin. In fact, I have such a head start because of my upbringing and who and my parents and the color of my skin. And it's like, who am I to say anything about it? She lit a fire underneath the ass of everybody in that room. She got a little bit of a pushback from a couple of idiots. I will call them idiots. But that was the first like gigantic bell that rang in this community in 2014 when she was like, I see you. Why are you not saying anything? And so now more and more people in the community are like, please don't remain silent when stuff like this happens. Like we understand that you want to post a DIY birthday cake how-to. Fine.
Which is fine, yeah.
Which is fine, but you have a platform. Why are you not saying something?
Right. I mean, silence is worse than saying something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just goes back, and I did read your post about this, and then I even went onto Facebook and read the whole comment thread. But which was grand
which
in some parts.
If they're unfamiliar with what happened on Facebook, I linked to a Washington Post article that quotes quite a few leaders in the Black Lives Matter movement about what white people who feel helpless in this, our privileged helplessness in this, what we can do to make any significant progress on this. And the first comment on that Facebook post was from a woman that I graduated high school with. I didn't recognize her at all. And the language in her comment is just, it was just like my childhood. It was like, I'm so tired of having to care about blah, 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 blah. And I'm so tired and all lives matter. And I, had had a really, really stressful week. I mean, the week was itself just horrifying with night after night after night of something horrifying happening. And then the usual stress of everyone's work week. And I just sort of lost it on her at one point because she wouldn't be quiet. And I was like, oh, you're Southern. Bless your fucking heart.
And then everything kind of seriously derailed from there.
Yeah. And
I think to anyone listening to this, and maybe when we post this on manicramblings.com, when this episode goes live, we should put a link to that Facebook post so that people can read the comments. Because I think from my perspective, aside from some of the just worthless attacks back and forth, there were some really excellent points made that helped kind of clarify things for me in some ways. You hear Black Lives Matter, that's the movement. And then there's all the, yeah, but all lives matter. And I know that that's not the direction we need to go. I get it. But someone, I don't even know who it was, in one of the comments said, that's not the point. It's just like when you say we have to save the rainforest, it doesn't mean fuck all of the other forests. It means these need our attention right now. So that's what we need to do. And that I just think it's kind of an interesting way to look at it.
Well, it's not just the ones that need our attention. The rainforests are dying.
Well,
Black
exactly.
People are dying.
Right. Like all lives do matter or should matter, but they clearly don't right now. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. That's why it's Black Lives Matter. there's a reason that that exists. So there's I guess my point is there's definitely some good content in those comments,
right,
for sure.
And from the article that I linked to, the quote that I had pulled out talks about how white people have to do the work themselves, not black people. White people have to do the work of dismantling the system and teaching each other about racism and the institutions that perpetuate it. And we are the ones who have to talk to each other. We are the ones who have to open each other's eyes. And that's our responsibility. And I think that's where, oh, do I even say this? That Facebook comment sections can be possibly a good thing, is when you have someone who spent years being an ally, which I know a lot of people are really hate that word right now, but people who for years have been working on the front lines and in advocacy and have been doing this work, who can come in with the language that needs to be shared and say, no, this is how we talk about things, and this is how we frame things, and this is how we get people to see their privilege. And hosting those conversations, I think, is super important, which is why I think it's so important to say something, because then it opens up the possibility of the conversation to happen. And that's where it has to start.
And the conversation has to start somewhere. And I know that in your blog post, you mentioned another woman that you know that you grew up with posted a very long comment that kind of slapped everybody back in line, very appropriately. I mean, it was a very well-written comment. And
a black woman, one of my best friends from high school, Shanae Boyd, who basically came in and said, "Shut up, all of you."
Well, it was shut up. This, you're totally off topic. But mm-hmm. But she mentioned, and I wish I had it in front of me. And if I had Facebook, I could probably pull it up really easily. But she said something like, you know, you don't have to have the same opinion as somebody else, but you have to be willing to listen and realize that maybe your thought process is not correct. But that is the step. That's the piece that's like the crucial piece that's missing. Like sitting here right now, this is going to sound really strange, but I don't care if there are people out there that are racist. If they're willing to sit down and say, okay, this is why I feel that way, and then I can say my side and we both look at it and say, okay, well, what needs to change? But the problem is that people get so entrenched in their views that they won't change. And when they're so entrenched in views that really have no foundation, it just creates this vicious cycle. And then to sort of segue into it, then, you know, these people who have these racist feelings for no reason have kids, and then their children are raised to believe those same things, because, well, that's how it works with kids.
I think racist for no reason. I mean, I grew up in the South. I was racist for a reason, because I was taught that. I was taught to feel that way.
Oh, that, right. Yes. So the reason is that you were taught that. But in terms of why do you not like black people? There's not a reason other than I was told to not like them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so then you just kind of get stuck. Like, well, okay, but that's not really
an
explanation.
Good,
no,
yeah.
Like, at all. But then talking to kids about it is a whole separate ball of wax, because engaging with adults in conversation is one thing, but then trying to talk to your kids about it is totally different.
It's extremely different. It's extremely different in Utah than it is in Memphis, Tennessee, where I grew up. The racial tension in Memphis is palpable everywhere you go. The idea of race is everywhere. It is the South. It is the heart of the South. And I think, and this shows you how far I have come and far I have to go, but I am one of those white people who thought, well, if my kids don't see color, then we're going to fix this problem. Like, if I can just teach my kids to be colorblind, then we can fix this problem. And all that does is perpetuate the problem, because then you're just ignoring it.
Right. And I struggle with that, because I think you are ignoring it, but you're trying to do the right thing. I think people assume that not seeing color is fine because everyone's the same. But what about recognizing the difference and celebrating it and being okay with it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think what sort of opened my eyes to that notion was after the tragedy in Orlando. And someone I follow on Twitter, Jason Hudson, he posted a couple of great Facebook responses to that tragedy. You know, as a gay man, what is his response?
Oh, I know Jason.
Yeah. And they were incredible. And I don't know if it was both of them or the second post, but sort of the essence was, don't say that you don't care if I'm gay, that it doesn't matter. You know, embrace the fact, enjoy that fact, and celebrate me being gay and still like who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never viewed the, you know, I don't see color or I don't care if you're gay or this or that as a negative thing. But then hearing him kind of put it in that light gave it a different spin. You know, you ignoring it or just pretending that everything is equal across the board always and everyone is the same really just lets things slide.
It lets the struggle and the inequality perpetuate.
Yes.
I actually had a conversation with several of the mothers and fathers at school. I said, how do you talk to your kid about race? And their response was, what do you mean? And I said, well, how do you talk to your kids about race, like about racism? And their response was, oh, we aren't racist. So what do you mean? And that's a big, big, big disconnect in the white community is thinking, well, I'm not racist. So as long as I'm not exhibiting racist behavior to my children, then we don't really need to talk about it because they're obviously learning from my stellar example of not being racist. And then they were very surprised when I said that I was starting to have active conversations with Lita about it. Like, and they were like, why are you even bringing this up? Why are you teaching her to see color? And I was like, well, one is because her fellow black classmates will grow up in a completely different paradigm than she will. And she will never have to worry about being pulled over because a cop sees her skin color and is suspicious.
Right.
And the reality of what I have to teach, like, I mean, I keep seeing this again and again and again on social media is the different ways that white people talk to their kids about police and the way that black people talk to their kids about police. And it's they're worlds apart.
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and I think the important thing, you know, like you're starting these conversations with Lita. I've started to have them with Lexton. But I want to sort of make this clear to everyone listening that we're not sitting here saying that we have the answers, you know, how you should have these conversations, how they should go, what you should say, because we're kind of still, I guess maybe I don't want to speak for you, Heather, but I'm still kind of figuring that out.
Oh, we're
as
two,
I go.
We are two fumbling white idiots.
I mean, completely.
Completely. Yes.
And I think, you know, when I talk to Lexton about it, it's funny because his initial response is, why are you even talking to me about this? Like, why do we have to have this conversation? Because he doesn't care. Not he doesn't care about black people, but he doesn't even see why there's an issue because he doesn't see why there should be inequality.
Yes.
Which is great because there really shouldn't be. But it makes it hard to initiate that conversation and to explain why we need to have it. Like, you have to justify having the conversation, and then you have to have the conversation.
You sort of, especially with children, Lexton and Lita's age, you need to choose what you show them of what is happening. I mean, the videos, there's certain videos that Lita shouldn't watch.
Oh, yeah.
But there's certain segments of the news that I will have her in the room for, so to give her context for the conversations that we do have.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, you can only shelter so much.
And this goes, I think what you spoke to, like my kids have never seen and will never understand why gay people were denied the right to marry. For them, it has been a non-issue since they were born. It's just not. And I think their generation is just going to scratch their heads and their children are going to be like, what? That was ever an issue? And that we haven't come that far in terms of racial equality is astounding because this has been going on for 400 years. But yeah, we still have, us talking about this is, I mean, I'm sure that there are a lot of people making a jerk off motion, but I think it bears at least explaining that I grew up in a very racist household. Now, my parents would take issue with that, and that's fine. That is how they look at it. But my parents grew up in Jim Crow South. They grew up when bathrooms were segregated and schools were segregated, and you couldn't drink from the same water fountain. I mean, they grew up in that system and in those places. And so my childhood was littered with, well, they're good people, but. So I grew up having with racist ideas, thinking that I wasn't racist. And I'm so ashamed that I didn't recognize it earlier.
When did you recognize it?
This is an interesting story. Thank you for asking that question. So do you remember Ebonics?
Do I remember? Yeah.
It was a huge, when the idea of Ebonics came out, I'm pretty sure it was in the late 80s, early 90s. There was a huge debate about it, of course, in the South, because how are we ever going to make Black people civilized if we let them continue to talk the way they talk? Like, that was how the discussion was framed.
Right.
Like, we can't encourage Ebonics because that's uncivilized. Like, they need to talk like civilized people.
Oh, my God.
Welcome to my childhood. And my parents were very vocal about this. And like, this is just ridiculous. We're indulging them. They want another handout. We're indulging this, you know, behavior that is unbecoming. And this goes back to the divorce where I tried to make my mom happy. So my mother was the most important person in my life, and making her happy was my number one priority in life. And I believed everything that she told me. It's very anti-intellectual of me, but it was like her love was so important to me that I never questioned anything.
Which I don't think is uncommon for kids.
I guess not. Lita questions me all the time.
Right. I mean, I think there's a lot of questioning in some areas, but I think there's other things that she just takes mm-hmm. at face value because you said that, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, so with my mother, they had that opinion about Ebonics. So I did. I adopted the opinion because it was my parents, and how could my parents be wrong? And I was taking a linguistics class my junior year of college. And it was, I was reading an essay by a woman who was explaining why Ebonics was needed and necessary and made sense. And I saw the title of the essay and I was like, oh, you know, I started reading the essay and I don't know what happened. But as like two sentences into the essay, I was like, oh, she's right. Wait a minute.
Like, it just clicked. This
completely makes sense. Like, there's a reason that Ebonics would help the certain Black communities, many Black communities. And it made complete sense to me. And I remember going back to where the apartment that I lived in, and my whole world kind of did a little pretzel movement and turned in on itself. And I was like, wait a minute. And this is, I'm so embarrassed to admit that it took me that long to go, what else are my parents wrong about?
Then you question everything.
Everything.
Oh, like, yeah.
I went back and I started to question. And that's when I realized that I didn't believe in the church anymore.
Wow. So this was a big turning point.
It was a big turning point. It broke open everything, like everything. It just cracked it open like an egg. And I realized, oh, wait a minute. I've been brainwashed about this, and I've been brainwashed about this, and I've been brainwashed about this. And I don't think it was ever, the intention was harmful. It was just that is how they grew up. That is what they grew up knowing. And they taught me what they knew. And I did not know to question it.
Right. Well, because, yeah, that's what they were taught. They didn't mm-hmm. question it. So that's what they teach you. You didn't question it. And had you not ever questioned it, that's what you would have taught Lita and Marlo, because that's how it works. it takes someone to stop and say, hang on, does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what you did. I mean, I was raised, I guess, in the opposite, but kind of a similar community, because in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, there are, you know, when I was growing up, like almost no Black people at all. I mean, I can think very specifically my entire K through 12 school career, there were five. Like I can count. That's what it was like. And three of them were training at a USOEC center for boxing and came up from Detroit. So really just two that were like born and raised and lived there for my K through 12 career. So everyone was sort of in this, well, there aren't any Black people, but we don't really have any problem with Black people. There just aren't any. So we won't talk about it because there's nothing to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to that saying, like, if you're not part of the solution, then you're part of the problem. So to stay in that middle ground, you're not only not helping, but you're harming. And if there are people listening that are doing the jerk-off motion that these two white people are trying to figure this out, that's really not helping. Maybe everything we're saying is total shit, but we're trying to find the right things to say. And you have to start somewhere.
You have to start somewhere. And my friend Kristen Howerton, she has this great quote. I don't have it in front of me, but it basically says, you know, when we talk about white privilege, it's not a personal attack on you. And we are not taking away from the fact that you grew up in the South as a white person in a poor, poor, poor neighborhood with, seven brothers and sisters, and you grew up with no money and you pulled yourself up and you graduated from college and you now have a stellar career. We're not taking away from that when we say white privilege. When we say white privilege, we're talking about an institutionalized systemic problem that has given our color of skin such a head start, so as a litany of problems has unfolded and perpetuated for years. And I think that for me was like, how do I start conversations with people about their privilege who don't see it? And it's like, I'm not taking away everything that you've done. What you've done is amazing. That you pulled yourself out of what you grew up in is incredible. And I'm not taking away from that. But when you look at a Black person in Black communities and you want to blame crime and you want to blame homicides and Black on Black crime, I hate it when people turn to that argument. We're looking at a framework that was built into the system of how this country works that has perpetuated problems of financial problems, education problems, you know, has destroyed families. Like it pulls families apart. And what the destruction of the family and what that has done to Black communities. And it has nothing to do with anything that you've accomplished in your life.
No.
And that's where I try to start with people who are just like, what do you mean? I'm not racist. I don't understand why I have to have this conversation with you.
Yeah. And not understanding it, not seeing it that's part of white privilege. Like that's mm-hmm. how it is. I mean, white people are put into a system that wants them to succeed. And I feel like Black people are put into a system that doesn't really give a shit. Like if you succeed, great. If you don't, we'll blame you rather than saying, okay, well, why didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Was it you or was it the system? And it's not, like you said, it's not a personal thing to say that, you know, a white person is solely responsible for this, like that this one person who succeeded is bad. But it is just this systemic issue.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You talk about growing up in an area, five Black people in your entire K through 12 experience. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Yeah. So Utah is, when you say diverse in Utah, you mean non-Mormon.
Wow. Okay.
It's like, we moved into a diverse neighborhood. That means a non-Mormon neighborhood. And so I think I sat down with Lita one night. It was, it was a couple of years ago. I sat down with her and I asked her if she had any Black kids in her class. And she was explaining to me that she doesn't see color. And I had to, you know, have the conversation with her where it's important that she needs to see color. And I think one of the reasons that she doesn't is that there just is not much diversity here whatsoever.
Right. So she literally doesn't see it.
She doesn't see it. No.
Yeah.
And and her school is actually pretty diverse in the non-Mormon way. There's several people of color in her class, and but she still doesn't see. Part of it is that I haven't instilled in her a notion, well, that Black kid, his parents are lazy. Like, that was what I was taught. And so I have not perpetuated that on her, so she doesn't see. She's not making a differentiation because of the color of anybody's skin.
Yeah.
One of the things that I see said over and over again from the voices that I follow online is, if you want to make one of the ways that you can really affect change is to diversify your friend group. Like, actually, I know you say you have Black friends, but actually go out and make friends who are people of color, and learn from them and be a part of their communities. And I think in Utah, it's kind of comical because people will be like, well, you want to move into this one neighborhood because there are at least five Black people in the class. And we specifically want to go to the school for that reason. And it's like, oh God, when does this become
really
artisanal? You know what I mean?
Wow.
Yeah. Like, it's so, people, liberals here are so desperate to find, are so desperate to diversify their friend group or the experience for their child that it's become this weird pursuit almost. And it's, at some point it's like, oh, okay, when does this become strange and wrong?
Well, exactly. And that's almost like a whole different,
mm-hmm.
but I think the real issue is that it seems strange and wrong because looking for diversity, like, because we have to look for diversity. But that in itself is kind of odd, like, to have to seek it out. I mean, I know that there are going to be some areas that might be predominantly more Black or more white. And for whatever reason, I mean, it's not like I think every single city in the world should be equally split, because what if people just don't want to live there? I don't know. I don't, you know, it's preference. But I'm sorry. I mean, nothing is ever going to be completely evenly balanced because choice comes into it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm towing an awkward line here, but that's not my point. But the fact is that you live in an area where there's so little diversity that people have to try and find it and latch onto it. And that's what makes it feel awkward. They shouldn't have to try to find it. It should just be there. Right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I guess I'm not going to say who said this because I don't want to, I don't want to make anybody mad, but let's just say that somebody that I know moved here from the South and said these words over a dinner one night, said, "Oh, it's not the black ones you have to worry about. It's the brown ones here."
What? And,
yeah. And I think that we, myself and my family, could do a better job of getting involved in the Latina community. There's a huge Latina community here in Utah.
That's how it is here as well, actually. Huge, mm-hmm. huge. Very, very few black people, again, but a huge Latina community. Huge. But that's interesting. Like, immediately that's what they move there and that's what they latch onto.
Yeah. And in this community is being assaulted by the idea of a fucking wall, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of outreach that we could do there as well.
But I think it's so easy when you are white to not realize how white your life is, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have, I don't know, this was when Lexton was maybe three or four or something. I think he was probably, you know, three. And he was picking me up from work with Heather one day. And I worked with one black man. That was it. Just one. And he would always make comments about it. Like, they had to have him there because they needed one, you know? And I didn't think much about it because that's a mistake. But so they picked me up and I got in the car and he could see in the building. And he said, he just kind of went, "Huh, who's the brown guy?" I'm like, "Brown guy? What do you?" And he's like, "Yeah, right there, the brown guy." And we both sat there, like, not really comprehending it. And it just dawned on us both, like, there are so few black people in this community that maybe he's never really seen any and noticed the difference. You know, it wasn't like a criticism. He just noticed, like, we're all white. That guy is brown. Like, that's different for me.
But, and that was an innocent.
Oh, it was totally an innocent observation, but it made me realize, like, wow, I lead such a white life in every single aspect of everything that I do. And this guy, his name was Robert. But when he would answer the phone, I heard it once and I asked him about it. He would answer it as Bob and his voice would totally change. And he hung up and I said, "What the hell was that about?" He said, "I live in a white community." He's like, "I answer the phone like a white guy." Like, that's exactly, like, flat out. And he was just straight faced about it. And I hadn't even occurred to me. And it's that kind of stuff that I, when it comes up and I realize that it hasn't occurred to me, then I just feel even worse. Like, mm-hmm. I don't even have to think about that stuff, but you do. Like,
that's
part of your everyday
life. That is his everyday.
Yeah. It's but you know, having that opportunity when a 3-year-old says, "Who's the brown guy?" I could have said any number of horrible things, and that would have just started him down that path.
Mm-hmm.
Or even not horrible, but just kind of horrible. I mean, like the comments that you probably got growing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, "Oh, don't you can't blame him. They're all just lazy." Like, then you can say, "Well, I'm not racist. It's just a fact." But it's bullshit, right? Yeah, and I realized just how easy it would be to take that path. And it kind of helps you see how racism just continues. I don't want to say innocently, but it kind of is, because, like you said, that's what I was taught.
And you have generations of Southerners who has been passed down one to the next, to the next, to the next. Which is why I saw this on Facebook this morning. We keep referencing Facebook. We're so old. I saw this woman posted this glorious, glorious essay this morning and said that we live in this world. She has to teach her son. We live in a world where 5 police officers are killed and every flag in the country is lowered to half mast. Yet when 12 black churchgoers are killed by a white man, you have hundreds, if not thousands, of angry Southerners screaming about their right to wave the rebel flag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, and that example is not meant to say that we shouldn't show remorse for the police officers, but it's, why is there not remorse for the churchgoer? Like, why doesn't that exist? There should be on both sides remorse.
And it's opening up, I think this conversation is sort of twofold. It's like, how do we open up the eyes to those who refuse to see, the adults who refuse to see the problem? And then how do we start talking to our children about what's happening and how they have to play a vital role in how things change? I think I mentioned, I read an interview with Brad Pitt, of all people, who was like, you know, our kids' generation will see gay activism as like, that is something that happened, and we have no comprehension of why it had to happen. Like, well, duh, of course they should be able to marry and have equal rights. And I think Lita and Lexton's generation, especially if we can open more eyes and more gets revealed and more gets recorded and more gets released and more gets talked about, that their generation is going to be pivotal in all of this, in this sea change happening. If a sea change can occur. I mean, I'm a white privileged person using that word. And, you know, I listened last week to so many of my friends online, just like, I didn't want to get up in the morning. You know, I don't want to get up tomorrow morning and see something else, because it kept hitting them like a wave crashing over them again and again and again and again. At some point you're just so tired. They're so tired of it all.
Yeah. It's almost, we're almost reaching a point of growing dangerously numb to it. You know, like you wake up and you read the headline and there's almost this part of my brain. It's like, oh, it happened again, because it happens all the time. Like, what do you, I'm not numb to it. It's not that I don't care, but I guess I read these headlines and I'm no longer shocked. And that's seriously problematic.
For me, what happened watching all of these women on Facebook recording themselves talking about their children and how all of this makes them afraid for their children, what I did is I thought for a minute about what it would be like, and I will never know this. I will never truly know this, what it would be like to fear my child leaving the house every day. And so my kids just left for New York for 5 weeks. And I am so privileged to be able to miss them, to be able to cry myself to sleep at night because I'm going to miss them so much. You know, they've only been gone here just a few days. And
right. You're not going to worry. You're just going to miss them.
I'm not
going to
worry. I'm going to miss them. And I don't, like, I could see as a Black woman sending my kids away for 5 weeks and being absolutely terrified that they would not come home.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, is that for me is like, I have to do something as a woman who will never fear for my children's lives in the way that Black women do.
Yeah. And I've sort of gotten myself to a point where I look at it and yes, you're white, but you are a woman. So you are a minority in one sense. I am a white man.
Like, you're pretty white.
Like, the catalyst of every horrible issue that you see. I mean, it's disgusting and it's embarrassing. And I've gotten myself to a point where, you know, I know that I will never, ever be able to understand that fear. I'm not a mom, but I'll never have to have that fear. But the point isn't to try and understand what that fear is like, I don't think. I think the point is to understand why I won't ever understand it. Mm-hmm. Like, what system exists that makes it impossible for me to understand what they're going through? Because that's kind of what we're looking at. I can never be in their shoes. It won't happen in this country.
No.
But that's not the point. The point is understanding why. I think that's sort of how I'm viewing it when I'm going into this and saying, well, how do I need to educate myself? What do I need to do so that I can better understand and so that I can talk to my son about it?
So and that you can make a difference.
Right. And that's, I think, what sort of makes it hard, though, is because I'm looking to understand why I don't understand. And it's a really big gray area. It's important. It's not that, wow, it's difficult, so I'm not going to do it. But it is, it's a beast to tackle because it's been ignored for so long.
I think a lot of where white people can start is with a lot of reading. There's a lot of writing that has been done on that helps to educate us and helps us to realize how the system works and is in place and the machinations of it. And the book that Kelly Wickham recommended to me, the first one to read, was called, and we can put a link to this on the website, it's called The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. And it's a sprawling, gorgeous narrative about the Great Migration. And you should definitely read it because Chicago, it actually follows the story of a family that ended up in Chicago from the South, a family that ended up in New York, Chicago, and I believe LA. And it talks about how it's one of the biggest migrations of the last century of people, one of the biggest migrations of people, period, happened in last century, happened, you know, over a 60-year period in the United States, where people fanned out from their homeland and populated the rest of the United States and had to somehow make a life for themselves in these cities. And these cities, what happened is that these cities saw this huge influx of Black people coming from the South, and systems immediately got put in place to subjugate them. And those systems are still in place today. And you definitely should read it because it talks a lot about what has gone on in Chicago.
Yeah. No, I saw that you had like a list of, I don't know, mm-hmm. at least a dozen probably books. And I will admit to being one of those people that didn't really know what to do. And I wanted someone to kind of tell me or help me. And I think it was that article that you linked to on Facebook that was like, you know, it's not our job to tell you. You need to figure it out. Mm-hmm. Like, it's already out there. The information is out there if you want it. And you got to start somewhere. You have to start somewhere.
Yes. Reading is a really wonderful thing.
Yes. And it's critical in this case.
For me, it started with an essay about Ebonics. I mean, that changed my entire worldview.
Yeah. Well, you let it change it.
I want to say that I was smart enough, but I'm not that smart.
And maybe it just came at the right time for you.
Yeah.
Without you really realizing it. I mean, maybe it just hit at the right time, but it needs to hit more people at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just does.
Well, and I need to learn from Kelly's example to me. And see, God bless her. God bless this woman, because she could have been, you know what? Fuck you, Heather Armstrong. Like, you are a goddamn adult. Go read a fucking book. Like, she could have just like written me off and said, I'm not going to do your goddamn work for you. And she was so level-headed with me and said, start with this book. This is a great place, you know, especially considering your family's history. This is going to be something very meaningful to you. She started a dialogue with me, and which I think is important for us as white people to do with each other. Me screaming at someone is not going to, you know, move the meter at all. It's about, here, let me break it down for you. Again, like, you're not going to run into a children's hospital and scream, well, there are adult sick people too. You know, I saw that tweet somewhere.
Yes. Yeah.
let me break this down for you in a very calm, matter of fact, very rational, logical, and an even warm way. I think white people have to, this, and white people have to be fragile with the fragile whiteness in order to destroy the fragile whiteness.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. And I've seen a lot of good analogies come out on places like Twitter. And I don't remember that comedian. Oh, I can't remember her name. I just drew a blank on it. Starts with an A. I know that you follow her as well.
Aparna Nancharla.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I don't remember exactly how she worded it, but it was something like, you know, saying all lives matter is like going to a funeral and saying today is also my birthday. So can you not?
So can we not?
Like and it's such a great way to look at it. I mean, it really simplifies it. Like, yeah, it might also be this, but that doesn't change the reality of what's in front of us.
No.
But yelling and screaming and, you know, to go back to that Facebook post, blaming it on the liberals or blaming it on the conservatives or blaming it on Hillary or blaming it on Trump, none of that shit matters at all. And all it does is let people write things off, be like, ah, they're liberals. We don't need to listen. Yeah, you do need to listen. We might not agree politically, but that doesn't matter here.
Mm-hmm.
It just derails everything. I think it's like this intentional subconscious thing. Like, I don't really know how to talk about this. They must be liberal. They must be conservative. And that I know how to talk about because I can just yell about it. And it's easier than race.
Yes. It's easier than confronting something that you've believed and thought to be very true for your entire existence. It's much easier to label things and scream and yell and block than it is to engage in, you know, and it has to happen on like, I have to be able to say, okay, this is a conservative woman from the South, and this is her experience, and this is her fragile white feelings. And
right.
It's my responsibility as a white woman to deal with her white fragility, not a black person. That black person does not need to deal with that white woman's fragility. No.
No, they have to deal with everything else that we've dumped
yes.
on them to deal with.
Well, that we've built and institutionalized.
Well, exactly. It's like, I think turning to black people and saying, you know, help us see is kind of like saying, can you explain to us what we did wrong? And then you need to fix it too. Like that really defeats everything. And I mean, I don't want to just sound all chipper and cheery like everything's going to be great, but I'm hopeful with what social media has done to expose this. You know, that's kind of how we started this whole episode. You know, that it's always been there, but now we're seeing it. And I don't want to see it. I don't want Lexton to see it. I don't want anyone to experience it. But I think seeing it is already has been and is going to continue to be a huge catalyst for change, I hope.
You hope. I mean, things will probably get a lot worse than before they get better.
Oh yeah.
But someone in my Facebook comments, you know, was like, what's a list of really good books for kids? Where can I start with my kids in terms of talking to them? And someone linked to an article that lists several really, really good books for kids. And we can link to that on our, on the website when this goes live, and, just tools for you to get the ball rolling with your children, especially if you live yeah. in states where there isn't much to talk about
yeah.
because diversity is means non-Mormon.
And I will say that, and maybe I've just not seen these in the past. Maybe they've been there and I haven't seen them. But over the last, you know, week or two, I've seen a lot of people linking to, I don't know if it's the same document and it just keeps evolving, but a Google document on how people who are not black can help, what they can do. These documents are very intentionally not written like, let us teach you, but here are places to go and things to do to teach yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not written in like a, we don't have time or we don't care. It's if you really care, here, we took the time to put this together. Now you need to take the time to educate yourself. And it's full of book recommendations and websites and phone numbers to call and things to get involved in and organizations to start. And it's awesome. And I've seen it pop up on Twitter dozens of times, and I'll see if I can find that to include as well, because I found it really, really valuable.
Yeah, I would like to see that. I don't know why I haven't come across that yet.
I mean, I think there's so much happening with all of this that you and especially on Twitter, you really only get pieces,
mm-hmm.
right? Because there's so much information coming in, and a lot of it is not great. because that's how this is going to go for a while. But in the meantime, I think the best that anybody can do is to, well, I mean, teach their kids to see color.
Before my kids left, I hosted a final sleepover, and a couple of their friends were over for the night, and I like to turn on the evening news. I know it's terrible, it's gross, like they sensationalize and they distort things, but I like to turn on the NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt. And I started to turn it on, and Lita's friend was like, "I'm not going to watch this." And I was like, "Really, you don't want to watch?" She goes, "I don't watch the news. It's never good news. It's always terrible." And I'm not her mom, but I did say this. I said, "Well, that's why you should watch it."
Yeah.
I don't think that you should be avoiding it. Not even at 12, I don't think you should be avoiding it. I know you still have your innocence, but there's a lot of work to be done, and we have to start exposing our children to all of it.
Oh yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, like we said earlier, there are certain things that we don't want them to be exposed to, at least not initially, right? Certain videos or certain whatever. But, you know, my mom doesn't let me watch it because it's all bad. So it's like we edit out things that are pretty significant. But if you look at what's being absorbed on social media or in the movies they watch or in the music they listen to, and I'm not a fan of censorship in anything. That's not what I'm getting at. But to censor out reality and nothing else, it just doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm with you. The news is shit sometimes. I mean, they do sensationalize, they do spin. But if your choice is watch it and try to make your own decisions or just pretend it doesn't exist, your best option is to probably watch it and come to your own conclusions about it. Otherwise, you stay ignorant. And ignorance is the most dangerous thing.
If we watch it with our children, we can give them context and we can give them direction.
Exactly. And it's not easy, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it.
No, and I know we would love to hear from you about how you talk to your children about these things and how where you live affects how you talk about these things and what your upbringing was like and how that has informed things. We would love to hear your stories, and you can email them to us at stories@manicramblings.com, and you can reach out to us on social media as well at Manic Ramblings on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
And until next time, start the conversation with your kids and your white friends and teach people to see color.
And when a high school friend of yours gets on Facebook and says, "I'm just so tired of," take a big deep breath. And it's your responsibility to deal with her fragility.
Many thanks to Tan Lines for the soundtrack, to Lisa Congdon for the cover art, and to Ryan Coomer for his expertise with the editing stuff.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.